Okay, so normally what I would say here is, if you got your scriptures handy, pull them out and turn to the place where we're going to be. However, because this is a little bit different evening, and it's a little bit different kind of a teaching that I'm going to do, it's going to be more or less traditional, but we'll make at least a few changes and some things to kind of try, because I know that some folks have already done the Seder. Some folks will be doing it like us tomorrow, and we're going to go through a lot of similar material again. So what I want to try to do this evening is talk a little bit about some of the things that might get overlooked. And the way I want to introduce that is a little bit different. We're going to do the news part of the teaching first. And in particular, what I want to focus on are some of the elements that I might suggest are similarities, whether we want to admit it or not, between modern slavery and ancient Egyptian slavery. And in the process of doing that, we'll work our way through the news too. So I'm not going to get right into the slavery part. We'll work up to that in a second. But let's talk about some of the ironies in the news. A lot of things I'm sure people heard about and are aware of, but maybe some others they're not. And here is one of those. So this kind of relates on several fronts. The University of California at Berkeley, one of the most infamous leftist institutions of what was once called higher education. I now refer to it as higher indoctrination in some respects. Anyway, this one is funny and ironic, and it shows you what has become of real education. It's been replaced with political correctness and BS. Bad stuff. Bad science. And it goes like this. Hundreds of employees at the University of California, Berkeley are getting some schooling when it comes to basic economics because they're out of work. The $15 an hour minimum wage that the liberal elites, including most of the school, were fighting for, they called it fighting for 15, has had an ironic but completely anticipated side effect. A week after California Governor Moonbeam Jerry Brown signed that $15 minimum wage into state law in California, UC Berkeley Chancellor sent a memo to employees announcing 500 jobs were going to get the axe because the school was already in financial trouble. They've got a huge deficit, and new minimum wage has just priced a lot of their employees at the bottom end out of a job. The funny thing here from the story says they need to have a chat with the folks at UC Berkeley's so-called Center for Labor Research, which claimed that the minimum wage was going to be a boon to low-income household breadwinners, that is, those that still have a job. All right. Another politically correct and sad commentary on the Times today, and I had missed this. I can't imagine why. Another pagan high holy day. We're coming up on May Day. We've had Beltane, all kinds of other various things dedicated to fake gods. May Day, as you know, is one of the days that is enshrined in communist lore. It dates all the way back to pagan rituals before that. And today, the 22nd, was called Earth Day. It was a day that the UN world controllers decided they were going to sign that little bit of BS called the Climate Change Initiative, the Paris Agreement. And there's an interesting piece commemorating that, written by John Coleman. And this guy was the founder of the Weather Channel. Now, the Weather Channel, as you know, got really politically correct. John Coleman is no longer there. But he wrote something to the effect of the following. With the Obama regime set to commit the U.S. to that Paris Climate Agreement, we don't need the consent of Congress anymore, don't need any of that kind of jazz, right? That was all what was once called law. Now they don't even pay lip service to it. Anyway, the document was to be signed today. It's obvious that science has taken a back seat at the UN to political correctness. And Coleman wrote that those who place the desired results ahead of science will realize money, politics, and ideology have now replaced science. And he goes on to quote a couple of other people that have, whether they want to admit it outright or not, kind of indicated exactly what gods are being worshipped there. UN climate chief Christiana Figueres has called for a centralized transformation that is going to make the life of everyone on the planet very different. No kidding. In order to combat the alleged non-existent global warming threat. And another UN official admitted that the UN, quote, seeks to redistribute de facto the world's wealth by means of climate policy. And the former head of the UN climate panel also recently declared that global warming is, quote, my religion. And I guess that is about as true as you'll ever hear words coming out of the mouth of the UN. Here's another one. Now, this is kind of an interesting couple of stories. We're gonna go through several things. We're starting to head towards this aspect of modern Egypt here. Of course, we got American Pharaoh. Earlier this week, you may remember, he was in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, where he was snubbed. The king couldn't be bothered to come out and meet the peon that was there on the red carpet. And it turns out that the reason Obama was called over on the carpet by the king in Saudi Arabia was because of some legislation that was being considered in Congress that is verboten. And that would have subjected the Saudis to potential liability for their connection with terrorism, the 9/11 bombings in particular. And remember those missing 28 pages that pretty much everybody knows show, because all the passports were Saudi passports of the so-called terror bombers. The stench goes pretty deep. And the truth is not going to be allowed to come out concerning what was really going on in 9/11. That's still being covered up, 15 years later. But Barry was there because it turns out that, and I've got the story here, the Saudi Deputy Minister of Finance had come personally to Washington and literally threatened, you guys had better toe the line or we're going to sell $750 billion worth of investments, primarily U.S. Treasury notes. This is Saudi Foreign Minister Adel Al-Jubeir took the message simply and personally to Washington. If you continue down the road with this 9/11 thing and admitting the terror links here, we're going to pull all of our assets and turn your financial world upside down. Now, we'll come back to that in a second. Anyway, so you had that happening early part of the week. The next day, or a couple days later, Obama literally wrote an op-ed that appeared in the British newspapers, essentially saying, "Don't you dare Brexit." In other words, Britons need to be subservient to the European Union. There are people over there that are starting to get uppity and think that they don't want any part of this EU mess. And Obama basically wrote a nasty gram. And I'm not going to quote a lot of the things were said here, but what was funny was the headlines the next day in all the British papers. I'm looking at the Daily Mail, Storm in the UK. Their headline says, "Obama under fire as he threatens to send Britain, quote, to the back of the queue if it dares to vote to leave the European Union." And then they went on to say, "Obama unleashed a furious backlash overseas over what has been called, quote, downright hypocritical by various EU or by various British ministers in a push for Britain to stay in the European Union. In a highly controversial intervention in the EU referendum campaign, how dare the U.S. president stick his nose into British politics, Obama pleaded with British voters in a local newspaper and then at a press conference not to cut ties with Brussels. London Mayor Boris Johnson accused him of making, quote, an incoherent and inconsistent argument." And he went on to slam the, quote, part Kenyan and called him hypocritical when it came to his Brexit diatribe. Even Russia Today got in on the act saying, "What Obama really wants to do to Great Britain? Why he wants him in the EU? Because it's all about imposing TTIP, the tyranny, public and private version that they want to stick in the European Union." So all over the world, there are issues with America. Now, this is the story that I wanted to spend a minute or two on while we're talking about Saudi Arabia and some of this stuff. And it kind of sets the stage. Because there's a whole lot going on here. We know about the Islamic invasion of Europe. We know, of course, about the fact that literally anybody that is a Christian or a Jew or a Bible believer in America, especially in places like the armed services, no longer welcome. Persona non grata. They kicked the creator and author of Scripture out of the schools literally decades ago. He's been kicked out of the White House for quite a while, but this latest guy has made it clear he didn't want anything to do with any of that jazz. He's fine with the prettiest sound in the whole known universe, which is the Muslim call to prayer, but not so much anything that has to do with Yod Heh Vav Heh or any other parts of Scripture, unless it's, of course, the, as he puts it, Holy Quran. So that's why the Saudi situation is particularly interesting as that breaks down. Now, if you hadn't heard this, I got an interesting piece. This came from the Daily Reckoning, which is a really good piece from Agora Financials, Bill Bonner's old group. I like these guys a lot. And they wrote a nice historical summary, it appeared today, about the money situation in the world and where we are. And if people haven't heard this, I think you'll find it interesting. You remember the Bretton Woods Agreement post-World War II that made the dollar the world reserve currency. But one of the things that they also required as part of that Bretton Woods Agreement was the dollar would be, you've heard this term, right, as good as gold, $35 an ounce. They would maintain that official peg. Well, they did for a while. But in the early 70s, the handwriting was on the wall, and the United States was, after the Lyndon Johnson era, spending itself into financial oblivion. Inflation was getting out of control. And along came a guy who said, I'm not a crook, but he lied, Tricky Dick Nixon. And Tricky Dick did something that was at the same time both insidiously satanically evil, and as this piece points out, satanically brilliant, too. He had help from Henry Kissinger, you know, Mr. Foreign Policy. And it goes something like this. Particularly, it was France. I remember thinking, it was a Charles de Gaulle that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. But given that lots of countries around the world knew they could exchange their dollars for gold. Now, American peons, the mere citizens, the ones that used to have God-given rights, they had not been allowed to own gold since the evil fascist dictator, FDR, on March the 9th, 1933, shut down the banking system and declared, the hell with the Constitution, we're going to send revenuers, IRS agents, into your bank vaults. If you've got any gold, we will take it. Oh, we're going to give you $20, and I think it was 40 cents for your $20 gold piece. Isn't that nice of us? Once they'd stolen all the American people's gold, the price rapidly went officially to $35 an ounce, but it didn't matter because you peons weren't allowed to have it anyway. So literally what he did was he stole almost half of the entire American public's savings, even if most didn't recognize it, by devaluing the dollar. Well, that went on for a while. And the only things that could own gold were international banks, foreign governments. And they did. And as long as they could redeem their dollars for gold, they did so, but not as dramatically as they did in the 70s. In the 70s, it started to come apart. So I got to Charles de Gaulle. De Gaulle was literally sending 747s over to the United States full of dollars and hauling gold bars back to France. And Kissinger came to Tricky Dick and said, this can't go on, we're running out of gold. What are we going to do? Well, Nixon unleashed a policy bombshell. Now, this is the day that I say the dollar died. This is the day that the United States dollar became officially fiat. August 15th, 1971, coming up on 45 years ago, Nixon announced he defaulted on the promise to pay. Literally, unilaterally, the dollar was no longer as good as gold. The United States reneged. It lied. It was a preemptive strike on a massive gold run, says the Daily Reckoning, that the U.S. knew it couldn't make good on anyway. But he created another problem. The value of the U.S. dollar was no longer based on anything real, and now they got a real issue. What happens when the hyperinflation comes next? And besides which, the level of faith in the almighty dollar was already near a historic low. So, here's how they put it. Say what you will about Nixon and his administration, but what they did next was pure genius. And it lasted for, 45 years. They devised a scheme that would allow the U.S. to have all the benefits of a fiat currency that you could print, without the usual side effects, hyperinflation. Now, what happened, of course, is it wasn't hyperinflation immediately. They just put it off about, four, maybe five decades. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger struck a deal, this is going to sound familiar, with Saudi Arabia's King Faisal for something he desperately needed. Right? U.S. arms, military support, military protection. The U.S. entered into an agreement that said, we'll protect you from whom? Well, anybody the Saudis are having trouble with. So we literally, if you think about it, made a deal with the devil. When you need something that you don't have, but you got something everybody needs, which is oil in this case, you need either to have the biggest military presence on the planet, or you have to have buddies that do. So you make an agreement with a country that does, Big Brother America. America's promise of military support to Saudi Arabia was worth an immeasurable amount of money. What could the Saudis offer in return that was of equal value without actually having to give America oil? Answer, the Saudis gave the United States the good as gold golden ticket, a competitive advantage that assured America would be the world's economic power for, four, maybe five decades to come. In exchange for protection, Saudi Arabia agreed to price all of its future oil sales in U.S. dollars and, here's the key, U.S. dollars alone, no other currency. Anybody in the world wants to buy oil from Saudi Arabia, they have to first have U.S. dollars to buy it in order to make the transaction. So when Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, it meant that its value was subject to, international supply and demand. But once they made the deal with the devil, oil only in dollars, the Saudis ensured there would be an enormous amount of growing demand for those fiat fake U.S. dollars. And you know the rest of the story, right? The petrodollar was born. When the biggest exporter nation agreed to price its oil in U.S. dollars, everyone else rapidly followed in line. You got Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Venezuela came on board. Then Qatar, Indonesia, Libya, up until they killed Gaddafi and stole his gold, and the rest of what is now called OPEC fell into line too. Once the entirety of OPEC was transacting oil in U.S. dollars, oil was priced the same way everywhere. And that meant if you didn't have U.S. dollars, you didn't have any oil. And since economies run on oil, going without it was not an option. And that created an incredible and growing demand day by day by day for U.S. dollars. And it grows along with the demand for oil each and every year. Right now, about 50 bucks a barrel or a little less, that comes into between $1.5 and $1.7 trillion annually. Nixon made it, they say, so that the U.S. dollar was supported by the entire planet's incredible thirst for oil. The deal with the Saudis firmly established the U.S. dollar, the fiat buck, as the reserve currency for the entire world, and that allowed the U.S. and its citizens to have a much higher standard of living than would have otherwise been possible. Now, they spend a lot of time talking about how this has benefited the U.S. over the years, but there was a negative effect too, of course. It gave the United States the ability to expand the money supply without limit, print, 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 and to get away with it, at least to get away with it for years without repercussions. The might of the American military owes a debt of gratitude to the Nixon regime, they say, and so does every other government program, almost all of which are unconstitutional. Most Americans today are richer on paper because of the inflated asset prices that have followed the petrodollar. And, of course, Big Brother gets to do what? Maintain its unusually low and even economically unsustainable interest rates and, of course, spend, spend, spend. But here comes the rub. The Saudis have a problem with Big Brother. It's not enough that they have essentially an Arab, Islamic president who's willing to kowtow to their every move. The relationship is strained nevertheless. Sign number one, this is all this week. The U.S. Senate was considering that weapons export ban or limits for Saudi Arabia, partly because, of course, we know that the ISIS terrorists are both U.S. and Saudi-backed, and it's becoming a little bit of an embarrassment to realize that the very people that we claim are terrorists and that we're fighting are the same ones that probably help blow up the World Trade Center, perhaps with a wink-wink, nudge-nudge, nod-nod from the U.S. and calling off its protection and so forth. And, the rest is history. A lot of other stuff that the American people, if they knew, and they're not about to find out from the press, would be upset about. There's that bipartisan bill in the Congress that would prove the connection between Saudi Arabia and the 9/11 attacks. That's an aggressive move, and the Saudis don't want anything to do with that. And, of course, this third sign, the Saudi king calls Obama on the carpet to, quote, talk about the economy. Yeah, and their threat to destroy it. All of the timing here is interesting, says the Daily Reckoning, to say the least. Saudi Foreign Minister, as we've already talked about, Adel Al-Jubeir, last month, took the message personally to Washington. They were going to pull their $750 billion in assets and destroy the U.S. treasuries unless you guys suck it up. So it's an interesting situation, and it all kind of has to do with this dissent. The Bible talks, as you know, about honest weights and measures and dishonest weights and measures. The love of money is the root of all evil, and what we've got today isn't even real money. It's fake stuff based on the petrodollar. And in a lot of respects, if you think about the connections to the dishonest weights and measures, who is the father of lies and dishonest weights and measures? Well, yeah, the prince of this world in all of his various guises. What do you call him? Baal, Molech, Hasatan, Old Scratch, or Allah. We're talking the same any other god except Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And this week we saw a few other things that really kind of, took the bloom off the rose. Here's a piece. If you were noting, this was the week, as of the 19th, when the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and it turns out there was a little more to it even than that, but the Shanghai Gold Exchange essentially went completely online as of Tuesday. The next day, Bill Holter, one of the guys that I like, wrote this with JS Mindset. We've been waiting, watching for April the 19th. It came out about like I expected. He says, truth has been exposed. China is now simply trying to aid markets to determine the price of gold and silver. Another story from Zero Hedge says the yuan gold fix, the Shanghai Gold Exchange, is about China being able to, quote, exert more control over the price of gold. They're sick and tired of the money manipulators, the Goldman Sachs and the JP Morgans and the big banksters that can sell paper gold without limit and maintain a lid on the price of something that they know they're never going to be able to deliver anyway. It's a fake. So China and the Shanghai Gold Exchange is about selling the physical stuff. And what happened this week was gold went up pretty dramatically. They hammered it a bit today in the paper markets. Silver up even more dramatically. Silver's gone from under $15 an ounce to over $17 an ounce in just a couple of weeks. And most of the commodity writers, analysts are pointing out silver is the biggest, highest performing commodity in the year 2016. Well, back to Holter. He said they lit the first candle. Ordinarily, when you expect a big move up in gold and silver, what the powers that be do is they slaughter it. They pre-bop the price in the crooked casinos. But that wasn't able to happen this week. And that alone is an interesting sign. Mining stocks, too, were up. So a lot of things basically are saying, now that China is really beginning to call the shots, we're seeing another nail in the coffin of the almighty fiat petrodollar. Then there's this piece. This also came out earlier in the week. Ron Paul, former congressman, candidate for president, asks a question, and the answer is nobody knows, at least it's not being admitted yet. What did the Fed chairman, Janet Yellen, tell Obama in that top-secret meeting, unprecedented meeting even, between her and Biden and Obama's the first? Nobody knows officially, but Ron Paul said this, according to that one paragraph statement, the only thing that the Fed has said and the White House, they exchanged notes about the economy and the progress of the American financial system and so-called financial reform. But American people, he says, have no way of knowing what else went on in the meeting. Thus, he says, the real reason, and particularly if you look at things like the Federal Reserve of Atlanta's estimate of GDP growth, which is basically it's not, there isn't any, it's zero. And that's pushing, well, what is it the president says? If you don't think the U.S. economy is doing as well as they claim it is, you're peddling fiction. Well, a lot of people are beginning to wake up to the fiction. Thus, says Paul, the real reason for all these secret meetings could be a panic that the Fed's eight-year explosion of money creation has not just failed to revive the economy, but it's about to cause another major market meltdown. So he's not alone in saying that the Fed is between a rock and a hard place. We're reaching the inevitable collapse of the fiat currency system. And the economic catastrophe that awaits, unless there's a smooth transition, could be something that dwarfs the Great Depression. So he says, you know, what we need to do is talk about liberty, and you know darn well they're not about to do that. There are a couple more stories along these same lines. Now, speaking of liberty, and of course, slavery. This is, I think, the thing that I want to make sure we talk about a little bit more. Here's a piece from Albert Edwards, who's the he's from Société Générale in the EU. This guy has a pretty good track record. He wrote an op-ed piece, basically an analyst piece, where he said, "I've had it." I'm quoting from his latest missive. This is a high-powered financial analyst. "I'm not really sure how much more of this I can take," was the headline. He says he feels utterly depressed because, quote, "there's not one scintilla of doubt that these central banksters," he said bankers, "will destroy the enfeebled world economy with their clumsy interventions, and the political chaos will be the ugly result." So he came out and really nailed it. He said this, "I'm neither monetarist nor Keynesian. I've heard Janet Yellen sees no bubble in the U.S. Ben Bernanke hones and restates his helicopter money speech. And Mario Draghi says the ECB's policy of printing money and negative interest rates was working." And he basically says, "Good grief, give me a break." Now, quote, "I feel utterly depressed." I could quote similar nonsense from the U.K., China, and Japan, too. "I have not one scintilla of doubt that these banksters will destroy the enfeebled world economy." We read that already. "And the only people who will benefit from all this are not investors, but anarchists who will embrace with delight the resulting chaos that these folks are fixing to bring on the world." Then he goes on to say, "I'm just not sure how much more of this I can take." We're 6 or so, 7 years maybe into the so-called economic recovery, and it ain't. So he's coming right out and say it. Andrew McGuire, London metals trader, former whistleblower, has said with King World News that, he summarized a lot of things this week. He too is talking about a gold and silver melt up and a stock market and paper asset melt down. Says what we're witnessing now are the first winds, the early stages of a perfect storm for much higher gold and silver prices, because the physical market, what with China, is beginning to dictate price and is constraining what the paper market actors can do. And he lists the catalysts. I won't read all of his comments because it's pretty good but fairly lengthy. This week we saw the launch of the long-awaited Shanghai Gold Exchange fix. It's been purposely underplayed by the mainstream media. And then hot on the heels of the launch of the SGE, the People's Bank of China and Russia's central bank announced their own joint gold trading platform. This is going to make a big impact in the foreign exchange markets. And as he put it, is, quote, "an act of war against Western central planners who have played right into their golden hands." And he says, you can go back and look at the history of how long it took to bring this SGE, the Shanghai Gold Exchange, into play, and why it was so hard fought against by the Western central planners. But they've lost the war against China's move to wrest away control and consolidate the gold market. China took years and years and years to build up their own gold holdings. And in a market that was once firmly under Western control, now they got enough gold that they can call the shots. This has huge implications, says McGuire, because there's billions, well, even trillions, maybe quadrillions, of underwater derivatives in dollars. And the threat is that the price is increasingly being set outside of the bullion banks. And he's talking even there's billions of dollars of derivatives just in gold and silver. So the pressures for a price reset in the precious metals markets are massive. China has played the long game, and the upside battle is now won. China forewarned the Western banks that if they didn't participate, they'd be barred from participating in Chinese gold markets. And furthermore, you better not manipulate, because they're going to deal with it the Chinese way, not the bought and paid for Western regulators way. So, says Andrew McGuire, this really is a game changer. And finally, add into the mix that Deutsche Bank admitted last week to colluding with other bullion banksters to rig bullion prices. And that's not all. We talked about this last week. The agreement by Deutsche Bank to release transcripts and emails to prove collusion is a huge deal. The sharks, he says, will smell blood in the precious metals market. Watch out above. Prices of gold and silver will soar. So we got all kinds of earthquakes, basically, that are going on in the financial markets. And literally, part of the upshot of this is that people who don't know they're slaves are in a world of hurt. One of the lines I like, I always thought it was Frederick Douglass, but I could never verify the quote. So I'll just quote it, And, you know, I like to give credit, but I'm happy to just use it anyway because it's a great quote. He said, "Let those who falsely believe they are free rattle their chains." And that's, I think, one of the things that I want to emphasize as we think about freedom from bondage and this time of the Passover. A couple of other items, too, from the news before we wrap this part up. Five major earthquakes already this week, and five of them just in 48 hours. You had the one in Ecuador. You had a huge 7.3 in Japan. You've had some volcanoes that are erupting, Popocatépetl down in Mexico again. And then the big news earlier this week was that seismologist Roger Billum at the University of Colorado made headlines literally all over the world when he said current conditions might trigger at least four earthquakes worldwide greater than magnitude 8.0. So he is literally coming out and saying we're set up for as many as four quakes greater than magnitude 8. This would be an indicator on the precipice of a wave of natural disasters unlike anything any of us have ever seen before. And furthermore, the strain accumulated during the centuries means more catastrophic earthquakes, mega earthquakes could be on the way. So basically what he's saying is the longer it waits, the worse it'll be anyway. And of course, remember too, and I've already mentioned this, tonight is the full moon, and normally tidal stresses are maximized at full moon and new moon, when the moon and the sun are either on the same side of the earth or the opposite side of the earth, and we kind of get the slingshot effect. And so that means that as many earthquakes as we've had, we could be set up here in the next 24, 48 hours for some real biggies. In Japan, the economy ground to a halt. A lot of car manufacturers and others with their just-in-time inventory system, literally the earthquake shut them down, and we're seeing the ripple effects. That's another big deal. USDA announced this week they're not going to regulate genetically modified Franken crops that have been modified with the CRISPR gene editing software and tools. The first out to shoot is a mushroom that has been genetically modified so it doesn't turn brown. And they basically said, hey, we don't see any need to mess with anything that's CRISPR modified. So the floodgates may have been opened, and as you might suspect, Natural News and others are saying this is a bigger problem than people are letting on. In California, there's concern about mandatory euthanasia so that, literally people can have their organs harvested. So be aware of that. Did who say when? This is the earthquake guy. Basically, he's saying just in this time frame. Usually, when a geologist talks about things like this, they talk in periods of centuries. Although he did not give a time frame. Just bear in mind that we've got, you know, every 2 weeks we have a new moon or a full moon, and so we're talking about those things. Yeah, people will point to all kinds of other stuff. You got CERN going on. There are all kinds of things happening in the world right now, and I guess that's really the bottom line. So. Oh, and I've got a story here I won't do, but about Obama and Yellen, and that was the reason that Dave Hodges suggests the Fed is panicking. And I've already mentioned this, that he and others believe that when Obama and the Pentagon, high-ranking members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, met with the Federal Reserve, you got to ask, what the heck is going on there? Answer, lots and lots of stories saying that Big Brother is planning for martial law when people realize that their life savings have been stolen. And, right, they thought they were free, rattle their chains. So let's close it. We'll have another song for a minute. As always, one of the things that I like to point out is we're supposed to know, be like the men of Issachar, know the times and the seasons so that we know what we should be doing and what Israel should be doing. And if we're part of B'nai Israel, even in exile, and we'd like to be able to reenter the land at some point, we need to come back into a place of obedience. We need the same kind of deliverance. We're looking forward to that greater exodus. So all of these things, it's interesting to me that Pesach this year is not happening at the same time of year as Ishtar Sun God Day. Some years it does. This year it doesn't. And I think perhaps that's one way of the creator of the universe and the author of Scripture helping us to be able to say, look, make a distinction here between the true and the false, between the things that are associated with his feasts, his Moedim, and these things that are utterly pagan and completely prohibited in Scripture. And then finally, again, this concept of slavery, of bondage. And remember, when the people that went with Jacob, under the protection of Joseph, the number two man in all of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, when they went down into the land of Goshen, it was really good for quite a while. Think about it. It's been really good here for quite a while. And slowly, without even realizing what happened, these people turned into abject slaves. No coincidence that this week was also it's not Tax Freedom Day, but it's Tax Day. And if you go back and look, when the money failed in Egypt, and when people literally became slaves to Pharaoh, do you remember what the number was? They worked Pharaoh's land. They didn't own their land either. Most Americans don't realize it, but they don't own their land either. And they basically, in order to be slaves on Pharaoh's land, they worked the land, and they had to pay the incredible tax rate to Pharaoh as slaves. You ready? Are you sitting down? 20%. Most Americans today, I think, would be thrilled, those that actually have real jobs and aren't making minimum wage up until they get laid off and so forth, with only a 20% tax rate. And when they actually look and see what they're really paying, it's far, far more than 50% in almost every case, because most of the taxes have been cleverly hidden. And of course, the most insidious tax of all, say the monetarists and the Keynesians, is the tax that most Americans will never figure out. Ha ha ha! Inflation. Now, I saw a piece. I'm not going to go through it tonight. I may save it and talk about it tomorrow. But there was a lot of discussion about Harriet Tubman being on the $20 bill to replace Andy Jackson. They don't like Andy Jackson, probably because he's the guy that turned down the second Bank of the U.S. And you may recall the famous quote. It's the only Andy Jackson quote I really like. I don't have a lot to admire about the guy, except for this one thing. He basically, when he was presented with the idea of chartering the second Bank of the U.S., he told him, in the modern vernacular, go pound salt. And more specifically, what he told the banksters of his day in the 1820s was, you are a den of vipers, and by God, I will root you out. So he was on the $20 bill, and of course, now he's not. They don't like a picture of a guy that doesn't like banksters on the $20 bill. So they're going to put Harriet Tubman on there instead. And interestingly enough, she was an anti-slavery activist, which is more than ironic. Anyway, the story that I was looking at said, even if you accept United States bogus inflation figures since 1913 and the founding of the Federal Reserve, and then through the end of the period of when the dollar was as good as gold, the $20 bill that Andy Jackson's picture was on for the better part of a century, that now they're getting rid of him, going to put Harriet Tubman on there, that $20 bill that was once worth a 1 ounce gold piece, $20 double eagle, is today worth maybe, at best, 89 cents. However, if you actually do the numbers and ask yourself, wait a minute, that $20 gold piece that Mark Twain wrote about in, Huckleberry Finn and all those other books from that time frame, if you actually remember that the $20 gold piece today is about $1,250, actually that gold piece itself is more than that. But that would mean that the actual dollar, the value of a $20 bill, is not quite 2 pennies. The penny, of course, isn't even copper anymore. So literally, you're talking about a $20 bill that when Andy Jackson's picture first got on there, today 2 pennies would buy what that $20 bill buys. Well, actually, the other way around. The $20 gold piece isn't worth, turned into paper, more than about 2 pennies. Nasty, nasty situation. No wonder, in other words, people have been enslaved and they don't even realize. All right, let's talk a bit about the Torah portion for this evening. And because, of course, we're headed into the week of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, generally people will refer to it as Pesach. And I guess you can argue about exactly what the names mean, Passover and so forth, but the entire sequence of events here is going to play out over just a bit over a week. And it begins with the day of preparation and then the time of the actual feast, which for those of us that are using the sighted new moon would be tomorrow at dusk. That first day, which at this point now would be first day, would be on Sun God Day. That is a day of no work, and it follows another day of no work, the regular weekly Sabbath. And then you get on the seventh day, count to seven again, and the next first day as well is. And then, of course, following that, we count the 50 days of the Omer leading up to Shavuot. So this literally is the beginning of the spring feast. It's a wonderful time. It is certainly a time as well when those people who understand literally the details of what happened about 2,000 years ago can point to all of the things that are outlined in Scripture there. You would not know. You couldn't understand without at least a good glimpse. It would help to actually have been practicing, to go through the things that the Passover says we're to keep and remember. So what we're going to do tonight is talk about the portion that goes with the Pesach, and indeed it's the first place where we get the big description in Scripture, comes from the book of Exodus, Shemot, chapter 12. And now technically, most of the Midrash says, well, Exodus 12, 14 through 27. I'm going to start at the beginning of chapter 12 and just kind of summarize a few things anyway, because it's just a one chapter portion. And this is a really key. Well, it's a key to everything that follows. And I want to start with this verse. This day, it says, shall be unto you for a memorial. You shall keep it as a feast. Oh, you keep the Jewish feast? You keep the pet? No. Read what it says, right? You shall keep it as a feast to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an ordinance forever. And I like to ask people the question, you know, for those that the Romanized Catholic paganized church says, along with the protesting Romanized Catholic, whether they like it or not, church that says, oh, all that Jewish stuff's been done away with. Excuse me. Who is to be the real master here? You or the Word of God? He says it's a feast to him. Now, I like the fact that there are Jews who say, yeah, it's a Jewish feast. Great. It ought to be our feast because it's his feast, and that's what matters. So he says, keep it as a feast to him throughout your generations by an ordinance forever. And I just want to pause, put a period there and say, okay, any questions? And let me just be as blunt as I can be. Why the hell has the church been lying about that for 17 centuries? AD 365. Council of Nicaea, actually it was after the Council of Nicaea, they started AD 325 and essentially said, oh, it's going to be anathema. We don't like this Jewish stuff. That's where this big lie came from. We don't like this God of the Bible stuff. He says keep it forever. Pah! We say no. We'd rather have Ishtar Sun God Day and all this other Mithra worship stuff. And it became anathema. And it became literally a capital crime to keep the feasts of Yah. So no wonder people today have accepted the lie that this is a Jewish thing. And of course they want to kill people still that follow exactly what it says here in genuine print. Keep it as a feast by an ordinance forever. It says then, you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread for this selfsame day. I brought you and your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, you shall observe this day in your generations by an ordinance forever. Well, he says it again. He keeps repeating it, almost like he knew that we were going to be told lies about it and not do it. All right, we'll pause there, because what I want to do, and he, by the way, a couple of verses later, he says it again, you and your sons forever. So, any questions? What about the word forever? What makes us want to call the creator of the universe and author of Scripture a liar? What was it that guy Paul says? They don't like to quote everything Paul wrote. They just quote certain things Paul wrote. Let God be true and every man a liar. Well, certainly there are lots of men that are liars at any rate. Especially those that say, these are Jewish feasts, we shouldn't be keeping them. They're done away with, nailed to the cross. And then they tell you, oh, it's all about the Messiah, and he died on the cross for us. On Ishtar Sun God Day. So you take the most important event in human history, or so they say, and you do what? You celebrate it with bunnies and eggs, and by doing things that the creator of the universe says are an abomination to him. Is there any incongruity in this picture? All the while denying that he says you're supposed to keep this by an ordinance throughout your generations forever. All right. Well, okay, so let's talk about what chapter 12 actually says, you know, as opposed to what men say God should have said if he was as smart as they are, and if they had funny fish hats like the popes did. Speak to the congregation of Israel. Now, remember, there are two things that are being described in the scriptures when it comes to this time of the Passover. The event we're going to hear about first in the book of Exodus is the first one. And then later that's going to be memorialized, and then still later we're going to see that it was really a shadow of things to come. And it was fulfilled, and then if we really, really can begin to connect the dots, we start to see, hey, interesting, if the spring feasts were prophetic, maybe so were the fall feasts, maybe we ought to be keeping all of them, just like he said, throughout your generations forever. So, the first one, Moses tells them, on the 10th day of this month, this day, this time of Aviv, the spring, the beginning of months to you, first month of the year, you take on the 10th day a lamb. And the idea is that they're going to have a lamb for a household. Now, if it's a small household, they can share a lamb with a neighbor. So be a male of the first year, can be from the sheep or the goats. So it could be a sheepy lamb or a goaty lamb. And on the 14th day of the same month, they keep it for 4 days, and then they kill it at dusk. Take the blood, and you know this part, they put it on the lintel, the two side posts, and above the door of the houses where they eat it, they roast it with fire, unleavened bread, and bitter herbs. And then there's some more instructions about how it's to be done, roasted with fire, and you don't let any remain till morning. And you're going to have your loins girded, shoes on your feet, your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Pesach of Yahuwah. And I had a discussion earlier today with Daniel Holdings, and he put it this way. I thought this was pretty good. I'm going to save it and use it. Be ready to go. And I think, again, that's one of the themes that I want to suggest everybody. As we go through the Seder this year, as we memorialize this first one, and as we memorialize other events that have come in history, that, you know, history does, to some extent it repeats, but as Mark Twain said, it rhymes too. The prophecies in Scripture are played out, I believe, more than once, and eventually we're going to see them play out in a way that is kind of the ultimate climax, and may we all live to see that. But in any case, there is an element of this that I'm going to suggest ought to resonate with us this year, not just this idea of slavery and of whether or not Americans know that they're slaves. They are. And in some respects, what they're fixing to see, I suspect, when the almighty fiat dollar, the petrodollar, that has looked good for a while, it's kind of like how a Coke addict really loves the hit, the rush. I've had people tell me, oh, Coke, oh, you ain't never had anything as good as that. It's better than, you know, this, that, the other thing, fill in the blank with activities that people think are a real rush. But you know what? They'll also say it's never as good as it is that first time. It just gets worse and worse. In other words, it's the drug addict's problem. They build up a tolerance. It's not quite the same. Well, the same thing is true with things like fiat dollars and other lies, other things that seem to be good for a while. They don't last. Unlike the things that the Creator says are part of His will and His plan. So maybe it's important to focus on this idea of be ready to go at a moment's notice. So I'm gonna again keep hitting that and thinking, you know, maybe this is the Passover where we need to emphasize be ready to go. Here's how you eat it: your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, your staff in a hand, and be ready to go. Then he goes and he says, here's what's going to happen. Now, this is actually where the story begins to pick up. I'm going to go through the land of Egypt that night, smite all of the firstborn in the land of Egypt, those that don't have the mark, those that didn't stay in the house or don't have the covering of the blood of the covenant above the doorposts, man and beast. And here's another line that kind of gets overlooked. See if this one doesn't resonate this year too. Against all of the so-called, I put that word in there, gods of Egypt, Mitzrayim, will I execute judgments. Ani Yahuwah. I'm the one God. I am who I say I am. I am that I am. These fakes, you'll see. Against all of the so-called gods of Egypt will I execute judgments. Except the blood is to be a token upon the houses where you are. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. No plague upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Mitzrayim. And then here's the verse I've already read. This day will be unto you for a memorial. And that's what we're doing now in this season. Keep it as a feast to Yahuwah throughout your generations, as a feast by an ordinance forever. 7 days you're to eat unleavened bread. First day, put the leaven out of your houses. Anybody that eats leaven from that first day until the seventh day, that soul will be cut off from Israel. Now, that's a big deal. I don't know about you, but I don't want my soul to be cut off. I'd a lot rather be cut off from that pagan Catholic church that says eat pig or die than I would the house of Israel that we're hoping to be not only grafted into, but regathered and brought back into the land as part of the sons of Israel. This is a big deal. So when I see this, it says, don't eat any leaven. If you do, you'll be cut off. That's a concern. The first day, there will be unto you a holy convocation set apart. And also on the seventh day, a holy convocation. No manner of work shall be done on them, except, some folks call it a cooking Sabbath. You are allowed to make food, things that you need in order to eat, that you can do. Observe, you shall observe this feast of unleavened bread. For in this self same day I have brought you and your hosts out of the land of Mitzrayim. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations by an ordinance, a chuk. And it's actually huchat olam, forever. First month, 14th day of the month at even, you eat unleavened bread until the 1 20th day of the month at even. So here we are, entering into that season, depending upon how you count the month, tonight, tomorrow night, for those 7 days. 7 days, no leaven in your houses. And he says it again. Anyone eats that which is leavened, that soul is to be cut off from the congregation of Israel. Whether he's a sojourner or one born in the land, don't eat anything leavened. In all your habitations, you shall eat unleavened bread. Is it clear yet? I guess it's important. Then Moshe calls the people out. He calls to the elders, says, get your lambs, according to your families, kill the lamb of the Passover, take the hyssop, dip it in the blood, strike the lintel and the two side posts with the blood in the basin, and none of you stay in the house. Do not go out of the house until the morning, because Yahuwah will pass through to smite the Egyptians. When he sees the blood on the lintel and on the side posts, he will pass over that door and will not suffer the destroyer to come in and smite you. And then he says it again. This must be important, right? He keeps saying it. You shall observe this thing for an ordinance to you and your sons forever. And when you get into the land that he's promised, you'll keep it. It comes to pass when your children say unto you, what do you mean by this service? Well, you're to say it is the sacrifice of the Passover of Yahuwah. It's a Jewish thing. Don't do it. We're not Jews. It is the sacrifice of the Passover of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, for he passed over the houses of the Bani Israel, the children of Israel, in Mitzrayim, in Egypt. He smote the Egyptians, delivered our houses, and the people, it says, bowed and worshipped. So the children of Israel went, and they did what Yahuwah had commanded Moshe and Aaron. They did. And then he tells them, at midnight, Yahuwah came through, he smote the firstborn, from the firstborn of Pharaoh on the throne to the firstborn of the captive in the dungeon, and all of the cattle too. Pharaoh got up, and Rashi says the language in the Hebrew is he was fired up. He was some kind of raring to go. He rose up in the night, all of his servants. There was a great cry, not a house in the land where there was not one dead, at least of the Egyptians. He called for Moshe, get out of here. both you and your children, go serve Yahuwah as you've said. Take your flocks, take your herds, and be gone. Oh, and bless me also. The Egyptians were urgent. They sent them out just as they were told in haste, saying, we are all dead men. The people took their dough before it was even leavened, their kneading troughs being bound up in their clothes upon their shoulders. And they did, according to the word of Moshe. They asked the Egyptians for jewels, silver, gold, raiment, and the people were given favor by Yahuwah in the sight of the Egyptians, and they literally spoiled them, took a lot of stuff. And 600,000 men of Israel on foot, not to mention a lot of children and women too, journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot. The mixed multitude as well. There were Egyptians, others, that came with them, with flocks, herds, very much cattle, and they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they brought forth out of Egypt, because had not had time to leaven. They were thrust out. They were in a hurry. They had not prepared for themselves any victual. Be ready to go, and they were. And then it tells us some other things. Israel dwelt in Egypt 430 years. Now, this is an interesting thing. We're not going to talk about this part tonight. How do you count the numbers? But at the end of that 430 years, it came to pass. This, therefore, is a night of watching unto Yahuwah for bringing them out from the land of Egypt. This same night is a night of watching unto Yahuwah for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. Now, I know people that will stay up all night long and pray for that reason, because of that verse. Yahuwah told Moshe and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover, no alien eats thereof, but every man's servant that's bought for money, when he has been circumcised, he can eat. Sojourner and a hired servant shall not eat thereof. Now remember, you're not supposed to have leaven in your houses. They're not supposed to eat leaven, but unless they're circumcised, they don't eat this special meal. One house, it's eaten. Don't carry it out. Don't break a bone of it. All coal, idot, all of the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And if a stranger wants to do it, let him be circumcised. There is to be one Torah, it concludes, for him that is homeborn and the stranger that sojourns among you. Thus, says, did all of the B'nai Israel. They did as Yahuwah commanded Moshe and Aaron, and that's what they did. Came to pass that selfsame day that Yahuwah brought the children of Israel out of the land of Mitzrayim by their hosts. So there is a summary. That basically is the chapter of Exodus, Shemot, chapter 12. However, I want to point out just one or two other things. Now, I've mentioned these on a number of occasions anyway. But I think as far as some other items to bear in mind, besides the one that you've probably gathered that Scripture hammers, and so do I, throughout your generations, keep it as an ordinance forever. It's amazing to me how many people will fall back on that old lie. Oh, that's a Jewish thing, and keeping the Jewish Passover. Excuse me. And it's hard. You've probably gathered this. It's hard for me not to get a little bit upset. It is not, and with no disrespect to those wonderful people who have the faith of Judaism that have kept it and have honored and preserved the Torah so that we can finally get back and do what it actually says, as opposed to what a bunch of liars in funny hats have said we ought to do instead. But it is a feast to Yahuwah. It's His. And if we want to be His, we ought to do what He says, because He says forever too. So here are a couple things. I want to make these points because in my experience, so this is just Markology, this is just things that I have found to be interesting and valuable over the years, because as you know, in years past, we've had the time of Passover approximately corresponding with Ishtar Sun God Day, and there's a whole lot of people that will say, oh, see, all that stuff's done away with, Jesus fulfilled it, we don't have to do it anymore. Well, excuse me, that's not what He said, it's not what the book says. I know that there's some liars that have said that, but let's read what He really says, right? And furthermore, there are some things that if we will just point them out to folks, I suggest they can be of real value as far as helping people to come to return, make teshuva to the things that the Creator says we ought to keep doing. Because the real problem here is we fail to teach our sons the questions that are asked routinely. Traditionally in the Seder, have to do with the things that it says, teach your children. Well, we have failed. to teach the children. And so what happens is we end up having to teach adults, and adults tend to be harder to teach because they've got a whole bunch of stuff, you know, the things that they know that just aren't true. I call it negative education. You got to unlearn that crap, get it out of your head, drop the baggage before you can get back to being merely ignorant, and then begin to learn something that's actually true. So here are a couple of them. One, Good Friday to Ishtar Sun God Day Sunday. And I've told this story 100 times. I heard Michael Rood tell it years ago. And what I thought was funny was he was saying exactly the same thing that I was thinking when I was 8 or 10 years old. And it boils down to this. Good Friday to Sun God Day morning. Ishtar Sun God Day. And I remember thinking 3 days and 3 nights. 3 days. That's not 3 days. It's not even 3 days. Come on. What kind of God can't count? And it bugged me. And it should. Because ultimately, people have been fed such a huge whopper of a lie that they end up thinking, Good Friday to Sun God Day morning, if they can accept that, then they have to deny everything that the creator of the universe said was going to happen, and they have to deny the very words that Yeshua said too. He says, no sign will be given to this nasty generation, right? Except the sign of Jonah, who was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish. The fish gadol. 3 days and 3 nights. Count it. That's 72 hours. Well, I remember thinking, there's a disconnect here. That New Testament's just wrong. Somebody's wrong. So, who's lying? Answer, it's not the God of the Bible. It's not the author of Scripture. And it's not the one who came to teach what's written in genuine print. Maybe it's those people that have been lying to us and telling us, don't bother to do things that he says forever to do. Well, okay, without a lot of discussion, because most everybody here knows this, they've already heard it, the real things that happened during the actual week of the Passover, at the time where Yeshua was executed, took place on a Tuesday into a Wednesday by our reckoning. The scourging, all of the nastiness happened literally in the middle of the night, early on Wednesday morning. He was punished, and essentially, when he gave up the ghost, as it says, that would have been on a Wednesday afternoon. And we know that, and we also know that there's so much that we've been lied to, because we forget how the Hebrew reckoning of the calendar and the days work. The evening and the morning were the first day. The day begins at sunset, the time of Erev, which is right about now. This is Erev. The new day is dawning. The Sabbath is literally dawning right now as the sun goes down. Well, Yeshua was in the tomb by 6 p.m. on a Wednesday night. So back to 3 days and 3 nights. Count it. Wednesday, Thursday. Nope. You can't count Wednesday because it was Wednesday night. Right? You see it? This is the important part. So, count 3 nights. Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night. 3 nights. Thursday, Friday, Sabbath day. 3 days. Precisely as he says. 3 days, 3 nights. Literally, that means he was out of the tomb before sundown. On the Sabbath, as it began to dawn on the first day of the week, not at the Sun God Day services or anything of the sort, as it began to dawn on the first day of the week. So here is another one of those places, and I can't tell you how many times over the years I've had people say, oh, wow, you know, once you begin to get rid of all the lies, that everything, you know, midnight, the day doesn't begin at midnight. The Greco-Roman day does, but it's part of the way you can cover up the truth. So once you begin to go back and peel away the layers of the onion and get the lies straight and get the truth back in, 3 days and 3 nights does actually work out. But you got to get rid of Good Friday and all those other whoppers in order to make that happen. And that brings up the other real big one, and this tends to just confuse the heck out of people. If you go through and read the English gospel accounts, it confuses the heck out of people because they don't realize one simple thing. Now, I phrase it this way. It's technically not quite correct, and you'll know why once you've been around the Torah a couple times. But it's this, that during the week of the High Holy days of the time, the season that we're in now, there are two Sabbaths during that week. There were two Sabbaths during the week. Well, technically, it was 2 days of no work. One of them was the regular weekly Sabbath, i.e. Saturday. The other was the day that we talk about, this first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That would have been Thursday on the English Romanized calendar. And now when you start looking at it that way, a whole lot of other stuff makes sense. The women that wanted to go get some spices, well, they can't get it on Thursday because that's the high no-work day. You're not going to do anything. That means the only day they had to go out and do any shopping was that Friday, so-called Good Friday in the middle. They were shopping, getting the spices and things that they needed to do to take care of the body. They couldn't do it on the Sabbath day. My guess is that they were there probably with torches or candles ready to do it because of what they suspected was going to happen to the body as soon as it got dark on the first day of the week. And then they discovered he was already gone. So these are two things, in other words, that as people think about the Seder and as they say, okay, here is the traditional stuff, the things that we're supposed to do, for those that want to draw the connections and if you will, bridge the gap with ex-Chianity, it's really helpful to be able to point out a few of these big whoppers that are real, real easy to debunk and say, okay, if you've never thought about this, 3 days and three nights. How about this one? There were not one, but two days of no work, two Sabbaths. And you can call that one that would have been Thursday back then, the high Sabbath, if you will, this day where it says you're to do no work except for cooking on that day. And that, of course, is a different day in different years. All right, those are the main things I want to point to. We've already kind of emphasized with the news the other one, and it's just this, that one of the themes that runs through the Pesach is this idea of bondage, of slavery. And I've said it before. I think Americans, whether they realize it or not, and indeed most people in the world, are fixing to enter into a degree of bondage that they have never in history been able to wrap their heads around. They already pay more in taxes than a feudal serf did. They already pay more in taxes. They're already more of a slave than the people who literally sold themselves to Pharaoh during the time of Joseph and paid a whopping 20% and didn't own anything. Ask yourself how a person that goes to an airport and the slave master says, I want to feel your genitals. I want to look at your wife's breasts on this X-ray machine here. I want to expose you to potentially, but we're going to lie about it, cancer-causing body scans with microwaves. And you can't say no. Can you say slave? Can you say, we own your body, slave? I tell you, I want to put my hands on your wife. What are you going to tell me, slave? This is not a free country. Let's not kid ourselves. The right to keep and bear arms, freedom of assembly, freedom of worship? No. And when it comes to the economic aspects, the level of slavery here is already beyond people's understanding. You got these idiots at the University of California, Berkeley, talking about how we want a $15 an hour minimum wage. That'll protect people. Yeah, those that don't get fired. This is just plain stupid. But it gets worse, because as the petrodollar melts down, and as the system that is inevitably going to fail, because they always have before, really, really unwinds, then things really, really get ugly. And I guess that's the thing that I think it's important to remember. Be ready to go. Understand that when this particular round of incredible slavery gets uncorked, that's part of the reason why you got to have martial law. You got to have troops on the streets. It's part of the reason why you got to have Obama meeting with Janet Yellen saying, how are we going to keep the peons in line when they realize just how badly we have stuck it to them? It's part of the reason why even people that aren't particularly freedom-loving, like a Donald Trump, but at least he's an outsider, is resonating because people are saying, we don't know what the hell is wrong, but it's really ugly, and we don't like any of these scumbags like Hitlery that has been committing treason and getting away with it to keep getting away with it. We've had enough of communists and others. Oh, you know, what choice do we have? Answer, give me anybody who's not a bankster or well-connected on the inside. Will it matter? I guess time will tell. I have a suspicion that it won't, but I'd like to be wrong on that score. The point is, there's no good way out of the economic situation. And when you look around and see all of the screws that are being tightened down for bondage, this is the year, folks, to go through the Seder, and as you read the part about cruel bondage, and as you read about the judgments on the so-called gods of Egypt, and as you read about the parallels that we see in history then and now, and those things that we can look forward to again, when he takes us out of bondage by a mighty hand, all of that ought to really resonate, perhaps this Passover as never before. So bear that in mind, Chag Sameach, and as you go through this Passover season, may Yahuwah bless you and give you eyes to see and ears to hear. May truly he guide you and let this Seder, this time of memorializing things that have happened in the past more than once and things that will happen again, may it be a blessing and may it really speak to us. And let's be ready to go.